The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. This is John Barber. That was Sarita once again singing Sunny with that gorgeous voice, and that was Francis Sinatra the night he took over the Tonight Show and had me on as one of your guests. I am talking to you live from Los Angeles, California, where on Thursday night we debuted our film, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It is May 29th, which is not only Memorial Day, it is also the day of John F. Kennedy's, the celebration of his 100th birthday, and it was sort of fitting that it would fall in Memorial Day because he, George Bush, served in the military on a PT boat called 109. It was made into a really interesting movie with Cliff Robertson. I am down here, as you know, for the opening of the film. Being John Kennedy's 100th birthday, if you go up onto Facebook, anybody's page, you will literally see thousands of tributes to murdered President John F. Kennedy. 95% of those are from women. So that is one thing, if he is up in heaven, that would make him extremely, extremely happy. But there's one thing that doesn't make me so happy, and that's this thought. Since the murder of John F. Kennedy, that was solved by Jim Garrison when he arrested Clay Shaw in 1967, and he had his investigation not only sabotaged by the government, but the fake media. Garrison said some in the media aided the killers before Dallas, and all of them, as you will see in the film, protected the killers after Dallas. Every single solitary political scientist in this country, sociologist, has pointed out in their universities and to their students that since the murder of John Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963, America has ceased to be a democracy. They all say it's now an oligarchy. That oligarchy is a house of cards, and it's peopled by card sharks. And as FDR said when he wanted to save us from the depression during the 30s, an economic depression, well, now we have an injustice depression in America. And to paraphrase or quote FDR, we indeed need a new deal. When the film opened, it had a sold-out opening night to Pacific Radio. The following night, the following day, we received an extremely dismissive review from the LA Times. The critic literally dissed the film and dismissed the film by saying, well, John Barber's brought up the usual suspects. Well, of course, I'm going to bring up the usual suspects. It's the CIA, but this time it includes the protectors, the media. And he dismissed me as being nothing but a curmudgeon with a grudge. Well, folks, he's right there, because I do have a grudge. I have a grudge against uninformed writers who are critics for mainstream media, like this fellow. There are hundreds of facts in the film, and he couldn't find one fact to refute, so he just ended up dissing me. However, scores and scores of people who saw the review came to see the movie. And one of the reasons they came to see the movie is because they heard me talking about it on my guest show. On two or three shows that I did, including Black Op Radio with Len Osonic, people heard it. Donald Trump didn't just defeat Hillary Clinton. He defeated the mainstream media, which supported Hillary. He succeeded because of social media. This movie is succeeding because of social media and the internet. And one of the gems of the internet is the man who is my guest tonight. He was one of the hosts, Art Bell. Art Bell, when he had the Coast to Coast show, had 5 million listeners. George Noory took over the show, and now they've lost 80% of their listeners. The only time they didn't lose listeners was when my guest was hosting on a Saturday night. He has a side. You know, I told him when I was on his show that there are four great voices. As somebody who's interested in show business and theater, I've always been fascinated by male voices. And of course, they were Richard Burton, one of the greatest actors who ever lived, if he hadn't become a celebrity and married Liz Taylor. And then, of course, there was Orson Welles, War of the World. And when I was a young man, it was Lorne Greene who came down here and ended up being Ben Cartwright on Bonanza. They're all gone now. But the last remaining beautiful male voice in America, with one of the most interesting and most listened to shows in all of the world on the internet, is my guest tonight. And I have to publicly thank him because he's one of the voices that keeps bringing people in to see my movie. And I must tell you, folks, those people who see the movie absolutely love it. And I would like to publicly thank and welcome John B. Wells, the voice of America. John, thank you so much for being here.
John Barber, thank you so much. And happy birthday to President Kennedy.
Indeed, happy birthday. I have a lot of... I was 30 years of age when he was murdered, John. Do you remember where you were, what you were doing, and if you want to, how old were you when he was murdered?
Well, I'm so old that I would have to look it up. So I cannot reveal that at this time because I'm not by the archive. But no, I was on the playground. I was a little school kid. And I noticed that it was one of those beautiful, bright Texas days at a beautiful blue sky, which we don't have anymore. Now it's overcast almost every morning. I don't remember the last time I saw a cloudless, deep, beautiful blue Texas sky. You got to get away from Dallas before you can see one of those, I guess. But the sun was shining and we were at recess, and or in Texas we say recess. Everybody else says recess. And the bell rang early. And I thought, I wonder what's going on. My dad was just one of those, he's just one of those men who raised his son and treated him like an adult from the very beginning. So that made it a little weird around the other school children, I wasn't wearing a watch in those days, but still I knew that the bell had rung early because I just have a, and even today I've got a pretty good clock for minutes and seconds and hours. But anyway, I don't mean to inject any braggadocio here, but when we went in, Mr. Young made the announcement over the public address system that was connected to every classroom that the president had been wounded in Dallas. And I said, wounded? That doesn't sound good. And then class was going to be dismissed. And so we left and went home early. And when I got home, my dad, a Pearl Harbor veteran, retired chief petty officer, retired because he left the Navy in 45. He was sitting at the table with his... wasn't tense, but his hands had been formed into fists, and he had one on either side of his head, and he just sat on the table like... He was never the same. He was never the same. He really wasn't. My dad was an interesting man. Very interesting. More I cannot really say, but over the years I've suspected that that was an unusual reaction, even for him. Dad was just, they didn't make him as tough, let alone tougher than Dad. He was about 175 pounds his whole life, 6'2". and just a brilliant thinker, brilliant analytical legal mind, and a charming man who could absolutely converse with anybody.
You said one of the most interesting things about your father that really struck home with me. You said that he talked to you always as an adult. You know, one of the dreadful things that I remember as a child, and I mentioned to you when I was on the show with you, I came from a severely dysfunctional family long before it was popular. And my father in 1939 ran away to the peace and quiet of World War II, enlisted in the Canadian Army. But I remember when he and my mother, they were big beer drinkers, and they would have these parties in the house, and they would talk to one another like you were talking to me. But once they turned to talk to me when I was 5 or 6 to get out of the room, they would talk to me like I was a child. And I sensed, hold it, why are their voices changing when they talk to me? So when I accidentally became a father, because I didn't want to have a child because I wasn't sure what kind of father I was going to be. But when I became a father and it literally changed my life, it was the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me, because I stopped thinking about my life and started thinking about my son's life, Christopher. I talked to him exactly the same way that your father talked to you. Now, when you got older, did you always have sort of an interest in John Kennedy and what happened to John Kennedy? Or did it just happen all of a sudden when you read something or you saw something?
No, I had a lingering interest in the John Kennedy assassination. By the way, congratulations on the success of your film. I think it's fantastic that you did it, and I'm not just blowing sunshine at you here. I'm really, may I just say that I'm very proud that you have done this, and I'm even more pleased that that you got the response that you did, and because it is a good movie, I'm just not surprised that the unqualified misfit excuses for people who claim, you know, it's one thing if you called yourself a film reviewer, but it's quite another thing if you are so completely consumed with yourself that you refer to yourself as a critic. So that means you're going to criticize it, which by definition is not a bad thing, but by implication, it's immediately negative. Typically, when I get a good review on a movie, I'll go and see it. For example, Manchester by the Sea.
Yes, yes.
Put my ration over there. But if somebody says, oh, it's a terrible movie, don't bother, don't go see it. You go and see it, and it's actually a pretty good movie. So I heard once upon a time that the movie critics and theater critics are frequently really bad sports writers who somehow maintain a job at the paper. So don't let it get to you, pal.
I saw Manchester by the Sea. It's an emotionally deep film, and it's very, very moving. And if you don't have the heart to sit through something that looks very real, the one thing that disappointed me about the advertisements about the film is they never mention in the film that it's a story of a fellow who accidentally burns down his house and burns his children alive, and then has to live with the results of that. So I had a woman call me and say, John, you must go see this film. It's so moving and it's so real. So I decided I stopped being a critic, because I had seen 1,000 movies for the 10 years I was the critic at OM Magazine and the 5 years at NBC. So I never went to the movie. But because she was so passionate on the air about going to see it, I saw it. So I didn't know what to expect, but I was literally stunned in the middle of the movie, or about a third of the way through the movie, when I discovered why the guy was so depressed, and he had to overcome that depression. And the wonderful touch in the film is he has to take care of his 16-year-old nephew, and the byplay between the two of them is so wonderful and so real. So if anybody would like to see a real movie about real people, and have a strong heart and a strong stomach, go to see Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah, it's sort of in sharp contrast to the older movies where, unless you start getting into some of those dark roles that people like Fred McMurray did, you know, like, Double Indemnity for starters.
Oh, yeah, Barbara Stanwyck, Double Indemnity. Fantastic. Yeah. I've seen them all. You can mention anything, and I've seen them all. And speaking of movies, one of the last things I asked Jim Garrison when I interviewed him, it was September 5th, 1980, when the interview was over. And, you know, sometimes, John, people can say things to you rather than showing you the facts. Like Mr. Garrison showed me the death certificate signed just after 1 o'clock by Dr. McClellan, that it was a gunshot head to the right temple that killed him. And you cannot find this death certificate in any of the exhibits, as you cannot find John Kennedy's brain. But when I was leaving, I said, Mr. Garrison, you're a very, very conservative person. You're politically unconnected. You were in the military, I believe a lieutenant colonel in the reserves. You're an FBI agent. Whatever made you think you could take on the federal government? And John, without missing a beat, he smiled and he said, John, I guess as a kid, I saw one too many Frank Capra movies. Well, that was me. There, that was me, and that was you. We were raised on that stuff as kids, you know? So that's why I fell in love with America, because their movies kept me company when I was an orphan in Toronto at the Manor Theater looking at them. And that's why I came down here, and I'm thankful I did. Anyway, do you have anything, any remembrance of John Kennedy when he was in office? And you obviously were too young, but as you saw films of him when you were older, was there something you read about him or something that you saw about him that particularly impressed you?
Well, he was the most popular president ever, meaning within the context of the age of television, and you could see all these broadcasts. I mean, media was really beginning to come into its own. It was still primitive and therefore quite fun. And a lot of people were freelancing, but, with their creativity, which was fine too. It yielded some interesting things, but you really got to see him. If you wanted to see the president in the 40s or something, you'd have to probably watch it on a newsreel, or you'd have to be in the 30s and listen to a fireside chat. But you could get something on the president anytime the what we call the mainstream media. I call it the Ministry of Smoke and Mirrors. Rather than MSM, meaning mainstream. You like that one? And Lord Christopher Monk calls it the Marxist stream media, but that's a subject for another time. The thing is, I liked everything that he said, but I was not your average kid. I mean, the average four-year-old doesn't say, I think when Mr. Rose asks, should we have some juice and cookies, I respond with, well, that's a very pregnant idea, Mr. Rose. And speaking of Mr. Rose, Norman Rose is another great voice too, okay? And my dad had me reading on a 12th grade level, on a high school senior level when I was in the first grade. So he just taught me how to think, and he told me that he did. So that combined with some wonderful coincidences made a pretty much a lifelong interest, and I never forgot him. I liked everything that he said. I couldn't understand why people criticized him. Everything from him being a Catholic to having his hair was too long and all this stuff. But then my dad went on the road, and he'd be gone sometimes for weeks and months in his business. And my mother and I lived in a guest house behind an old real estate lady named Helen Wessler. She must have been pushing 90 when I was in second or third grade. And her personal nurse just happened to be Marguerite Oswald, Lee Oswald's mother.
Oh, my goodness.
I met her before the assassination. And then, some years later, about 1985, I lived five houses down from General Edwin A. Walker on a street called Swannanoa, over in what we call Bluffview, over by Lovefield.
Oh, my goodness. Dallas.
So it was just one Kennedy thing after another. Then somebody else, a few years later, I can't remember his last name. His first name is Zane, and he worked with Anthony Robbins a lot, and teaches at New York U every Monday. He's there. He just never missed a day of school, but I can't call his name to save my life right now, I'm embarrassed to say. But he contacted me to do the first, it was a CD-ROM of all of the available Kennedy documents, everything that they could get on him, and I narrated it and had a little musical score done for him, and that went out. My kids were delighted when they were able to see that.
Oh, my gosh, that must be impressive. You know, you told me one of the most interesting sidebar stories. There are literally thousands of truly interesting sidebar stories about the assassination. But that story you told about what the first time you were at Dealey Plaza and you were up near the abutment where Zapruder had taken the film. Retell me that story. It's so compelling.
All right. And I'll streamline it in the interest of time. It went like this. Oh, and I forgot to mention, whenever the movie JFK starts and you hear the narration about the president being taken to Parkland and all that, that's me. But
Great.
But you will not see my credit on there because I was supposed to be playing Dan Rather, and an article came out of the Dallas Morning News, and the title was, "Why Do Dan Rather and Oliver Stone Hate Each Other So Much?" And I thought, when I didn't see my credit there, I thought, oh, I think I just got a hint as to why my credit's not on there. So anyway, it's not, but that's me. What happened was I had run out of gas on my Harley. I was a rock and roll disc jockey in those days, and a guy on an identical motorcycle, except for the carburetor, said, "What's up?" And I said, "I'm out of gas." He goes, "I'll be back." I didn't know this guy from a bar of soap. He went up and got some gas, came back, and I thanked him and invited him to come down if he wanted to see the studio because it was a famous rock and roll station. It was called The Zoo, 98 FM in Dallas, Texas, and I worked there at the time. And he came over like the next day or the day after. I was surprised, really, how fast he got back in touch. And he said he wasn't really interested in going up to the studio, and I could kind of see that anyway. So he said, "You know, I'd really like to go over to the school book depository." And I said, "Well, it's right over there. Let's just go." So we rode our bikes over. It took about 1 minute to get there. Parked our bikes behind it. And walked up from behind the building. In those days, this would have been about 1981. Yeah, it was 81. Absolutely, it was 81. And we pulled our bikes behind it. No big deal. No problem getting in. It was just an old building with a parking lot behind it. Blacktop parking lot. And we walked from behind the building, or actually the side of the building, the side that would be facing the triple underpass. Walked up beside that, at the back corner of it from the street. And the first thing I noticed was that the balustrade, the stone balustrade that goes across the triple underpass, came back up toward the school book depository building and terminated in about a 10-foot by 10-foot little garden area with a little piece about 2.5 feet wide cut out of the balustrade so you could walk into it. It was just taken out at one of the corners. But what alarmed me was on the floor of this thing, and look, folks, and John, you have only my word for this, but you have it. And I was stupid enough to use my real name on the air, so I can run, but I can't hide, okay? This is a true story. On the floor is a 2.5, maybe 3 foot, it was large, square hole with no cover, right in the middle of this thing. And I thought, somebody could walk in here at dusk or maybe dark and just go, wow, all the way to the bottom, you know? No cover, no safeguards of any kind, just a hole on the floor in the shape of a square with about a little over 1 inch thick U-shaped iron rungs sunk into the wall of the shaft, which went down a long way. I dropped gravel down there and I couldn't even hear it at the bottom. And as I was up there in this area, I thought, why has nobody ever mentioned this particular place? I mean, what is this? And I looked up Elm Street, the direction that President Kennedy and Mr. Connolly and all them would have been traveling. And it's been resurfaced several times, so a little bit of the grade has been taken out. It was slightly steeper before, and when I was there in 81, than it is today. But as I was looking up there, and I'm standing, straddling this hole, looking up Elm Street, I thought, okay, the road curves to the driver's right just a little bit, and it straightens up right just right at the midway point of the school book depository, and it's pointed directly at me. And oh, look, here comes a convertible, and there are people in it. Let me see something. And sure enough, right at the spot, and you can tell where the shot went off because there are enough landmarks. You can reference the exact point real easy. And if you need any help, there's a guy painted an X in the street every time he can sneak over there and do it. And then they erase it, and of course he puts it back as soon as he can, whoever it is, and we don't know. The rear passenger, somebody in the rear seat, their head was above that windshield frame. It would have been like shooting fish in a barrel, only even easier. And I theorized that the man, I believe that the two shots, the one that hit Mr. Kennedy in the throat and the one that hit him in the forehead, came from that spot where I was standing. I think somebody came up with their rifle already cocked, a bolt action, or maybe, who knows, maybe a semi-auto. I suspect it was a 270, and I believe that intuitively because, or based on intuition rather, because Jimmy Hoffa kept popping off about wanting to shoot somebody and use a 270. He specified 270, which was the post-World War II kind of hot rod cartridge because it's a neck down 30-06, which is what all the 30 caliber weapons, whether it's a machine gun or the Garand or the Springfield. In fact, it is the 30-06 Springfield. So I'm thinking, you come up this shaft, you've got the rifle slung on your shoulder, you come up, you on your radio, the guy says, get in position, 100 yards. He's at the corner. And we know that the car slowed down, don't we? Yes, we do, because we can see it. And Abram Zapruder's hand was so steady. You'd think this man had a Steadicam rig. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm filming somebody driving by and it happens to be the President of the United States and gunfire goes off, I might wiggle the camera a little. But that's just me.
You certainly would. Now, didn't you try to go back there at one time to rediscover that?
Yes, sir, I did. So just to finish up in about 5 seconds or less, you are already chambered. You wrap up into that sling real tight because you're a marksman anyway. And you shoot, and you rack the bolt, and you shoot again. And if you'll look at that, you'll see that the timing is exactly right. Those two shots came from the same guy. Now, there may have been other gunfire there, and they say that there have been, you know, hole in the seat and hole in the windshield and all this other stuff. And somebody made this bogus thing about the driver turned around and pulling a pistol with his left hand from under his right armpit. And that's just nonsense. Forget it. But here's the thing. I went back after, in 1985, I believe it was, or maybe... He could have been as late as 87. I'm thinking it might have been 87 because I moved to another place in 87. So, yeah, 86 or so. Whenever it was that Oliver Stone made the announcement in the Dallas Morning News, he was coming to Dallas to shoot a picture about John Kennedy. It was just a little article. It was about 3 inches by, you know, regular column width, whatever that was, but only a little short thing. I thought to myself, you know what? I better get over there and go take a picture of that thing, that little garden area. So I fooled her. John, I could just slap myself. I'm telling you. I fooled around for about 2 weeks, and when I finally went over there, it was gone.
The
whole balustrade was gone. It was gone, and it was black-topped over. You could bear. I was going away, but I had this. Now, here's the other part. I got to tell you this real quick. Where the Dallas motorcycle policeman had his Harley-Davidson motorcycle laid over on its side in the street, was looking down that storm drain. That's the storm drain that connects to the shaft that I was looking down. I bet my last dollar.
Well, you know, I have pictures. Jim Garrison always thought a shot came from that storm drain. In the Warren report, Clint Hill said one of the shots sounded like it was an echo. Garrison thought, well, that could only happen if there's a sewer or something. He sent Stephen Jaffe, his photo analyst, to Dallas, and I have pictures of Stephen Jaffe in the storm drain. There is plenty of room to do all the things that you're talking about. Yeah. And just like when you went back, it was covered in, they have also entered... They have also altered that storm drain.
Oh, they have. But get this, John. Do we think that if a shaft 3 foot by 3 foot on each side of the square hole that went down to that shaft, which then led to a chamber, a culvert, something that went to that storm drain, we think that a rifle being fired right by that hole in the little garden area would travel down the chute and come out the storm drain and make some people think it had come from there? Absolutely.
Oh, because a lot of people said there was an echo. Some people said they could smell smoke from the area that you're talking about. So let me ask you this one final question, and I have an observation that sort of saddens me. I'll give you my observation first. I think that today is going to be the last hurrah for John Kennedy and justice. I think our film is going to be the last hurrah, except that it is the definitive documentary on the murder of John F. Kennedy, the thwarted investigation, sabotaged by the media and the government. It is a film that will outlive the movie JFK or James Douglas's book, The Unspeakable. It will outlive them all. But my thought about why nothing will happen is this thought. We have been bludgeoned into becoming political, intellectual, emotional zombies. And the reason for that is we 9 out of 10 people for years and years doubted the Warren Commission, but we never saw a real investigation. Millions of people marched against George Bush and the lies over the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and it did no good. They still pursued that illegal fake war.
Yes.
Then we had to accept another Warren report, non-investigation into 911. And
yes,
everyone knows that that's a fraud. And
yes,
nothing is done about it. Our leading intellectuals and news people don't talk about it. So what has happened? I think people, I see that people who've seen my film, John, absolutely love it. We've had people come back a second and third time in just 4 days. People who are on the fence about what happened to John Kennedy, if they have a half-open mind, some of the facts will seep in. It's because it's an emotionally powerful film. But for the rest of America, the vast majority of Americans who are now political zombies, you could not pay them to sit and watch this film because they know if they see the truth, there's nothing they can do about it anyway, so don't show it to me. Now, I hate to be negative, but that's my thought. Do you have a thought?
Well, you know, you and I were taught to run toward the gunfire, not away from it. Get over there and find out what's going on. Help if you can. You know, use cover and evasion where possible, but go toward the problem. Don't run from it, or it's liable to chase you and overwhelm you. That's how we grew up. Face your giants. Act like a man. But that's a terrible thing to say now, because, if you know, masculinity is so threatening to so many people. John, this is, if I have ever seen the Alinsky rules for radicals played out and actually taken root. We thought most of that stuff was a joke back in the 60s. We knew that those guys were serious. They were capable of being violent. But did we ever, John, did you ever think you would live to see the day when people were for depriving people of their rights, not giving them more rights, but restricting freedom of speech, restricting freedom of expression, while all the time they want to push a sexual lifestyle of one kind or another? Oh, they don't want you to be able to say certain things because you might hurt somebody's feelings. I mean, this is insane. This is more dystopian than anything that I've read from any of the greats, like Asimov or even Brad Bradbury came the closest, but even he didn't touch the reality that we're living in now. And this is Memorial Day, and I said to people as on the radio show on Arc Midnight on Saturday night, from 9 to midnight Central, by the way, we don't want the being killed in a war is terrible. In many cases, it would have been more merciful to feed them through a brush chipper. These are our sons, some of our daughters too, and our dads and our brothers and our friends and our cousins. And who are these people to send us into these undeclared wars? What, for God's sake, what has happened to the American spirit, the love of liberty and of truth? And I'll tell you this, John Kennedy came for money. Bill Clinton did not. Harry Reid did not. Many others did not. John Kennedy did. And look what happened. We got a president up there now that may not be everybody's first choice. He's not Jesus. He's not a Messiah. But he is a man who is successful. He has a beautiful family and a beautiful wife. And with his own money, he became president of the United States, and Hillary Clinton still won't give it up. And because he is a self-made man, he is not going to kiss the boots of the so-called global elite. I ask everybody, if you love this country, you don't have to love Mr. Trump. You don't have to love me. If I wanted people to love me, I'd have become a vet. You support this president because your freedom is in jeopardy. And if you want to see how stupid it could look, look at some of these shows like The Handmaid's Tale. Now, that's an extrapolation, and it's weird. But people will get it. When a government becomes oppressive, what happened in Europe during World War II, that's not just pictures in a book. Look at Fury sometime with Brad Pitt. That's warfare. That kind of stuff
I gotta tell you, John, it's really interesting that you mentioned Trump, because whether you like him or don't like him, he has in his hands right now the authority to either release, as Congress mandated this fall, to release some remaining documents about the assassination of John Kennedy, or to suppress the release. And that's really interesting what will happen. John, I want to thank you so much for coming here. Thank you so much for doing the show that you do. Honest to God, the B must stand for blessing, because you are a blessing to us. Thank you again. A wonderful, wonderful, wonderful life to the rest, to your family, your friends. And I understand you're getting married shortly.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Well, congratulations. I can't thank you enough. And I'm telling you, the people who listen to my show, and there are quite a few of them, thankfully, they absolutely were thrilled when they heard that I was going to be on your show and you were going to be back here on John Kennedy's birthday. So thank you again, my friend.
You were so much fun. Thanks for coming on Caravan to Midnight. And like I tell everybody, John, if I suddenly drop off the scope, just come to caravantomidnight.com and you'll find me in one form or another.
Thank you so much, John. Have a terrific night.
God bless, John Barber. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back with Joe Satilli.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. A tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great VBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World. This is John Barber, and I'm talking to you from a motel room. It's called the Beverly Inn Boutique. And I must tell you, folks, boutique is a French word for dump. And the only reason I stayed here is because I put so much money into the film. I had to save it, and I wanted in the most desperate way to bring my cohort and creator and author of The News Vandal, which there are two great newsletters in the country, but Joe's is by far the best, the most objective and the most readable, and I wanted to bring him down here to see the film, and I felt terrible. I had no money left over to help him come down here, and he was too busy. Anyway, Joe, welcome to the show. I'm sorry that you couldn't see it on the big screen because it is so, so strong.
Well, obviously it's getting great reception. And if you don't know, talking to the listeners, there is a website, right, that people should go to that's out there on just a regular website. Also, sign up or at least follow the Facebook page, Second Assassination of John F.K., right? The media and the second assassination. And those are things that if we should get some links up, at least on BBS, if not, if everybody goes to your John Barber's Facebook page, they can get to those two pages so they can get updates because it's being shown now in L.A. It's going to go to New York, right, John?
Yeah, it opens June the 9th in New York. And surprisingly, we've done no publicity or promotion there, but when I called there to find a boutique where I could stay close to the theater, the guy answered the phone and said, "Is this John Barber?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You're coming in?" I said, "Yes. I'm going to go do Q&As." And he said, "Oh, how wonderful. We're already getting inquiries about your film." So that thrills me no end.
Yeah,
and I
great.
Heard of there's a very prominent professor in New York by the name of Mark Crispin Miller who said he's bringing a half a dozen people. We had two people show up here. One has written a monumental bestseller called Best Evidence. That was David Lifton. David Lifton showed up the other night just on his own, engaged in conversation, and then we went to Canner's afterward and had from Kreplik. And then there have been three real heroes in the research community, and of course you'd have to start with Mark Lane with Rush to Judgment in print, then Mae Brussel on the air. The right. one who is the heir to that now, very close friend of Oliver Stone's, is a guy named James or Jim DiGiugno. He has a site called KennedysandKing.com. He has come twice to see the movie. And he said, "John, I saw and learned things I didn't know, and I know a lot." So if he reviews it, or David, or whoever does, and we put it up on the site that you suggested, we will be like Trump. We'll conquer the world with social media. As a matter of fact, I entered it in the Moscow Film Festival because I want Putin to do for me what he did for Trump. So anyway, if you
John, I want to actually ask you something, because here's the
sure.
thing. If you haven't seen John's first film, The Garrison Tapes, it's basically the autopsy of the assassination that Humes and Boswell never did, right? I mean, it really, if you want to know the details of how the assassination worked, what happened, it is a must. It's actually, it's square one. That's square one. The second part is the wonderful follow-up, which I think has not just you recounting some of what happened in the first film, but also expanding on that, giving Jim Garrison more opportunity to speak, and then your reflections as somebody who's spent a lot of time not just looking at the assassination, but fighting to bring it public and to bring details public. And so a lot of people who listen actually know a lot of the details, or they're interested in the details, but I wanted to ask you, because here we are on the 100th birthday of John F. Kennedy, and he was a man. He was a human being. And not just he was a man and he was a human being, but he wasn't just an event that was a scar on the psyche of the American people, but he was a president. And he was a. There's a reason why the psychic scar he has left has been so deep. And it's not just because of the glamour of his wife and Camelot and all that, but because he was a specific human being in a specific role at a specific time in an office that he was able to do some incredible things in a short period of time. I always come back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I think is one of the amazing examples of leadership in the 20th century. And I wanted to ask you for your reflections on John F. Kennedy, the president, before the assassination, and what your memories were of him as a president, because I know at the time you were doing comedy, you weren't particularly political. I was just wondering what your reflections are on his presidency here on his 100th birthday.
What a great question, because the truth is I was never, ever political. I loved him. First of all, he was the only president ever, because of his manner, the only president ever who made emotional contact through the camera lens. You can't look at any. It's like a great actor. It's like Cary Grant. It's like Paul Muni. It's like Robert Donat. Somebody who has an emotional impact when they're on camera. And so I loved to watch him because I could write great jokes. But I was always moved and surprised by some of the brilliant things that he did. One of the things that I remembered most profoundly, I think I was about 29, writing jokes, is they used to have these wonderful dinners at the White House, and they would have singers, they would have entertainers. That's what Bush and all the other dreadful presidents had. But he had intellectuals, and he had a dinner one night. There were 18 Nobel Prize winners. There were poet laureates. There were Peabody winners. There were their leading intellectuals in America in the room. And his toast to them was, "Ladies and gentlemen, there has never been so much brain power in this room since Thomas Jefferson dined alone." Now, can you imagine a Donald Trump or a Ronald Reagan or a George Bush saying anything like that? I mean, I remembered when I was introducing, when I did the last word on the assassination at UNLV before the students, and I was making reference to the fact that John Kennedy was the most intellectual president since Thomas Jefferson, who by far was the Michelangelo of presidents, regardless of what he did with black girls, you know. And look at John Kennedy was no different than Thomas Jefferson. And John Kennedy and Garrison were alike. Jim Garrison had a mistress while he was married. And when his wife divorced him, he married his mistress. These kinds of men have great sexual appetites, okay? And remind me to tell you about the greatest columnist in Mike Royko in Chicago. I'll talk about that. But in any event, when I mentioned to the students, if you ask George Bush about Jefferson, he'd probably say, "I hear it's a pretty good high school." I mean, it's just unbelievable. And then, of course, I don't know anything about business. I don't know about the economy. But I do remember there were threats by the steel companies in Pittsburgh when we had steel companies in Pittsburgh before Clinton signed that and sent them away. They were going to raise the price of steel. Now, it always bothered me, but I never said anything. You go to five different gas stations for gas, and the gas is the same price per gallon, whether if you go to Shell or you go to Sunoco or you go any place, it's always the same. So you can't tell me there's not price fixing with selling gasoline. And so it's obviously true with steel. John Kennedy called the president of Pittsburgh Steel, and he said, go ahead and raise your prices, because when you do, there will be one less steel company in Pittsburgh owned independently. We will nationalize your steel company if you raise the prices. They never raised the prices. Could you imagine any president now threatening major businesses like that? As you've said, and Chris Hedges has said, we've become a corporatocracy in this country.
Well, and who was one of the last presidents to operate with any kind of, I'd say, wiggle room? Because I've always regarded John F. Kennedy to be the last American president. In other words, he was the last president to have the audacity to think that the office of the presidency afforded him the right to exert all of the rights and powers of that office bestowed upon him. And over the course of the last 50 years, we've watched successive presidents be boxed in by the momentum of the establishment, whether it's the military-industrial complex, well, now we have the financial-industrial complex, we have the health insurance-industrial complex, we have these large sort of conglomerate powers that have a braid with government, particularly through Congress, because Congress doesn't really have much in the way of restrictions on insider trading. So you get a guy like Tom Price at HHS who spent a lot of time creating laws that would benefit the stocks that he was invested in. So we're in this weird zone now, but you know, Nixon, what did he do? He put in price controls and he gave us the EPA, and he did a lot of different things that he end run around.
He also recognized China, which
yes,
no
China.
Liberal president
yeah.
could do.
Yeah, the end run around the national security establishment and opening a channel to China. So, you know, when you think about Kennedy and what might have been, and that's the other counterfactual that everybody likes to think of, is there one thing that stands out in your mind when you mourn the loss of the president, what America lost when it lost him?
Well, it lost a man who could literally make a difference, not only in America, in the world. And there is no question in my mind today that this country will never allow a president like that to be ever elected again to sit in the Oval Office. The other really sad and heartbreaking thing to me is that there will never be another district attorney like Jim Garrison, who had the courage to take on the federal government, including the Central Intelligence Agency. I mean, when he sits in the film on the Johnny Carson show, and it's a close-up shot, and he's looking into camera, he is saying an element of the 7th Central Intelligence Agency murdered our president. I mean, you will never hear that again. And that's why they got rid of the fairness doctrine. That's why they got rid of equal time. No one like that will ever hold high public office again, because what they do is they murder the peacemakers. They murder the lawmakers. And look, Bernie Sanders, I hate to say it. You know, I never wanted to get involved politically, because I remember Jack Parr saying, I don't vote because it only encourages them. And then Mark Twain said if voting made a difference, they wouldn't let us do it. And that was 100 years ago. So obviously, the corruption that Mark Twain saw then has now, it was seeping up during Mark Twain's time, but now it's a tsunami of corruption. And I think in that respect, America literally is doomed for change. What the change is, I don't know. And I don't know if it'll come because of Trump. And I'm really curious to get your impressions. Do you think he will release those documents that he's supposed to release, or will he suppress them?
You know what? It is such a wild card, because if there is something in those documents that is damaging – to the intelligence services, I would assume that that would be something he would want to do simply for the sake of doing it. Do I think that Donald Trump is interested in the getting to the truth of what happened? I really think it doesn't really matter to him whatsoever. If it's a political cudgel that he can wield, he would be willing to do that. And frankly, I wouldn't care why he did it as long as it's done. That's the only thing that matters to me.
You know what? I think you're right, Joe. And again, I want to thank you so much, first of all, for the fabulous news vandal. I want to thank you for your contribution to the film. And before we sign off and say goodbye, please tell us when we can hear you again, and please tell us where we can get your news vandal.
Well, I will be on the Ocelli Effect. I'm there every Tuesday from 6 to 7 Pacific time. Then I have Inside the Headlines I do at 2 o'clock on Crew FM, and you can listen to that online. That's every Friday. That's 2 p.m. Pacific. And you can just go to newsvandal.com, and a little box will pop up. You can sign up. But I would like to implore everybody listening, get to John Barber's Facebook page. Through that Facebook page, you can get to the various websites, particularly the Facebook group for the second assassination. That's where you're going to get all your updates, because right now, showing in L.A., it's going to go to New York. But after that, it's going to hit the film festival circuit. But very, very soon, it's going to be available to everybody. And you want to be on top of that so you can see it as soon as it's available, whether it's going to be over the internet or in a theater near you. That's where you're going to get your updates. So get to the Facebook page so you can and follow it so you can get the latest information on where you can see John's new film.
Joe, thank you. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. I want to thank Mike Kim, my producer, without whom I could not do this show. As Ed Murray used to say, good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny.